Ashton looked away. 17 seconds. She pulled her robe tighter around herself, finally covering up.
And you destroyed a young man's chance at passing.
We could retest, she started.
You know we can't.
Once supplicants know it's not real, the thresher doesn't work.
Everyone would say it was because he got special favour for being my nephew.
I didn't mean...
And you know it,
Gavin said, only keeping his voice down with effort.
It doesn't matter what you meant, Mistress Varidos hissed.
While the mistress was speaking, Gavin split some superviolet from the light of the torches, just a little. The beauty of superviolet was its invisibility. Even though there were at least half a dozen people in this room who could see superviolet Luxon if they tightened their eyes, Gavin was betting that none of them was tightening her eyes at this very moment. And even if someone was, what Gavin was about to do was so small and so quick that even someone looking might miss it. Magical sleight of hand. The superviolet settled into his fingertips.
You broke the rules, Tisus, the mistress said. You botched your duties, and you may have destroyed a young man's future.
But nobody passes, the young woman protested.
It had become a mark of pride just to hold on for a long time. Conspiracies, the dark, tight spaces, heights, spiders, snakes, rats. The thresher hit all of the most common fears. Usually, believing that failure would mean the loss of everything, and with their eyes dilated from fear, the applicant drafted any and all colours before they pulled the rope. It wasn't perfect, of course, but it was the best test they had.
Get out of my sight, Gavin said.
She went, huffing, furious, crossing between Gavin and the mistress, just as Gavin had planned. He pulled a stone from his pocket, holding the short rod behind his wrist, slid the samite off the hole, flicked invisible superviolet out of his fingertips, and used it to snatch the testing stone out of its grooves. He snapped the Luxon back to his wrist, binding the testing stone to his forearm with bands of superviolet, and with the last of the superviolet in his finger dropped the false testing stone into place. It had all taken less than a second, and Gavin hadn't so much as leaned over.
"Well, let's see what we have, shall we?" he said, still drawing the rich samite cloth away from the hole.
In full view of Mistress Varidos, Gavin set the samite aside and reached into the receptacle, leaning over, grabbing the testing stone, and pulling it out. The testing stone was an ivory bar, either from sea demon washed ashore or from elephants deep within Hrothgar, tipped on each end with obsidian. The ivory was precious, but the obsidian was the real wonder. No one knew where the obsidian extant in the world had been harvested or mined or made. Obsidian was rarer than diamonds or rubies, so after every testing, the obsidian ends of each testing stone were removed to be reused. The superstitious called it hellstone. Most drafters were just happy that it was rare, because it was the only stone that could draw Luxon directly out of a drafter. Gavin had heard that in the ancient world kings and satraps, and in more mythic tales the assassins of the Broken Eye, had created entire daggers, or even swords, of obsidian. But obsidian only evinced its magical properties when two very special conditions were met. First, it had to be in near total darkness, that is, a total lack of light in the visible spectrum. For some reason, superviolet and subred didn't interfere with it. Second, it needed the drafter's blood, an open cut at that. There had to be a direct physical connection between the obsidian and the Luxon, for the Luxon to be drawn out of the drafter. When that connection was made, however, the pull was quite strong. Cut a drafter's shoulder with obsidian while he was holding Luxon in his hand, and hold the stone against the cut, and within maybe 10 seconds the Luxon would be gone. Scholars speculated that was because drafters had Luxon throughout their bodies at all times, so the connection was direct, even if it was distant within the body. Because the rates at which obsidian pulled colours out of a person were different for the different kinds of Luxon, they made nice lines as they were pulled out of the body and into the ivory. If a colour formed and stayed and was thick enough, the supplicant was deemed worthy of receiving training in that colour. If there were two colours, of course, the supplicant was deemed a bichrome, and more than two made them a polychrome. Gavin took the testing stone. He caught a faint whiff of cloves that was the scent of superviolet Luxon. He held it for just a moment, willing the scent to disperse, and handed the stone to Mistress Varidos. As the head tester, it was her place to declare the findings. As he did, everyone else gathered around. She carefully removed the obsidian tips and stowed them in a special box, and then held the testing stone over her head. There was a clear, thick, green bar peeking toward the blue side, and next to it a less full blue. Yellow was faint. There was a tiny bit in the superviolet. It was a classic bell, the most common pattern in drafters. The mistress said, "I hereby declare Kip of Recton gifted of Orholum in the colours green and blue, with superviolet undecided and to be tested further at a later date. Kip, congratulations. You're a bichrome." A cheer went up. Only Kip still looked confused. Gavin walked around the table, put an arm around Kip's shoulder and squeezed. "Well done, Kip." Kip was limp in Gavin's embrace.
"So I passed?"
he asked quietly.
"You passed. You made me proud."
Another cheer went up, and within no time, wine and brandy and special cakes and fruits and meats and sweetmeats were being produced by slaves who flooded the chamber. Gavin released the boy, who was looking at him like he was utterly befuddled, like he couldn't believe the words Gavin had just said. Some of that, too, was the magic. The emotional effects of every part of the spectrum had just passed through Kip for the very first time. He didn't know yet what to do with the residue. It took time. Gavin gestured toward the door, beckoning Oliviana.
"Kip," Gavin said, "I brought you someone special, a surprise for you. She'll be your mentor. She'll explain how things work and teach you some of the basics until we leave. Kip, may I present—"
"Liv?"
Kip said as the girl stepped out from behind Gavin.
"Kip!"
"Why don't you go ahead and take him up to his room, Liv?" Gavin said. "And remember what I said."
Kip was still in a daze, so Liv took his hand and turned to lead him toward the main door. There would be a crowd there, no doubt. No need for Kip to think anything was out of the usual.
"Why don't you go the back way?" Gavin said.
He turned and flung Superviolet at the opposite wall. A section of the wall popped open on previously hidden hinges. Liv took Kip out the back door. Commander Ironfist and Luxlord Black came in the front door.
"Luxlord, Mistress, Commander, Magisters," Gavin said, waving a friendly hand to show he was simply too busy just now to speak with Ironfist or Luxlord Black. He walked toward the back door himself. He needed to get Kip now. He should have commanded the boy to wait outside the room instead of sending him upstairs. Gavin stepped through the back door, already composing the letter he would leave for the White, and almost ran over a dark, demure little man in a slave's robe. He recognized the man, and his heart dropped.
"Greetings, Lord Prism,"
the little man said, his headscarf so starched it barely moved as he bobbed his head. He'd been a Parian legalist before being captured by Elysian pirates, enslaved, and eventually sold to Andros Gyle. Brilliant and discreet, he'd been Andros Gyle's right hand for 20 years.
"Your father tires of your delays. He demands you come to his chambers immediately."
With Andros Gyle, immediately meant yesterday. Gavin cringed inside, popped his neck right and left, and said, "Take me to him."
Chapter 46 Kip followed Liv Danavis through a narrow hall and then out to a lift. His head was still a whirl, and his emotions were a riot that seemed not completely internal, as if somehow additional emotions were being pressed onto him. It felt alien. Maybe it was just seeing Liv. He'd known she was at the Chromeria, and he'd hoped to see her ever since he'd known he was coming here, but actually seeing her was different. Master Danavis had shared many of Liv's letters with Kip, so in some ways it didn't feel like it had been 2 full years. But she'd been 15 then. He'd been 13. Apparently, he'd grown since then because he was finally taller than she was. Of course, he was still also about 3 times wider than she was. If anything, she was even more beautiful than she had been. As she led him through a hall and finally to a lift, she didn't say anything. Kip was glad for the silence. He didn't think he could have found his tongue. An odd, quiet joy and peace settled over him at seeing her.
He remembered when she was 14 years old and the rumour had run around town that she was going to be betrothed to Ged, the Alcaldessa's son. Shortly thereafter she'd left for the Cromeria. Kip had been relieved. She'd seemed too good for little Recton, but though he was sure she hadn't thought of him since, he'd missed her. She'd been like the sun passing overhead, and he'd turned his face as she passed, warmed by her presence, but never daring to hope for more. When Master Danavis had shared that Liv was having a hard time with some girl at the Cromeria, Kip had wanted to leave immediately and kill the offender, then come home. Seeing her wavy hair swish and bounce around her shoulders as she led him was like standing in the sunlight again after a long winter. Kip didn't want words. Once he opened his big mouth, he'd surely spoil everything. He just watched her walk, hiking up his own pants gracelessly, as she strode ahead purposefully, at home, at ease, in command of her environment.
"I think I'm lost," Liv said.
She looked to each side, down halls that looked exactly the same. She bit her lip. Eyes locked on that full, slightly moist lip, Kip gulped.
"Kip," she said. "No, never mind. Of course you wouldn't."
She headed off again, and Kip followed. Liv had turned into a woman in the time she'd been away. She was as slender as he was fat. Her eyes large, lucid brown, her skin smooth and clear, where his was cursed with pimples around his neck and jaw, as his beard was only just coming in. Thank Orholm, at least her chest was bigger than his. Kip barely glanced there, though, and now as he followed her, he barely looked at her body. Her skirt did swoosh back and forth in a most pleasing manner as she walked, revealing slim, well-turned calves. But aside from a glance or two, or maybe three, Kip glanced again. Ah, four. Aside from that, he didn't look at her the way he'd look at some other beautiful woman. It just didn't seem respectful. Oops. Five. She stopped when they got into the lift.
"I just realized," she said, laughing at herself, "that I have no idea where I'm supposed to take you. Tell you what, you can come to my room until I get this figured out. If you're like I was after the threshing, you'll probably need to go straight to bed, right?"
Kip wasn't sure how he hadn't noticed before, but he was tired. He felt as if someone had taken the bottle of his energy and shaken it all out. He nodded his head.
"Don't feel like talking?" she asked, giving him a little grin.
It was the kind of grin you gave a little child who'd missed nap time and was fighting to stay up to get dessert. But Kip couldn't even summon the passion to despair at seeing that indulgent grin on her.
"I'm cute to her." Cute. Ugh.
She set the counterweights on the lift, paused for a moment. She must have been surprised how much weight she needed to add to account for Kip, and added more. In moments they were speeding up the tower, passing other students going both up and down. They stopped and stepped into a wide lobby area that dimpled out to one of the clear tubes that connected the central tower to all the others. Kip looked at Liv, eyebrows up.
"My apartments are over in yellow. Yellow's in the middle of the spectrum, so bichromes and polychromes include yellow more often than other colours, so the yellow tower has more bichrome apartments. They don't have the space for those in the prisms tower. Are you afraid of heights?"
"Not usually," Kip said uneasily.
"Oh, so you can talk."
"I can fall too," he mumbled.
"You'll be fine, I promise," she said.
She walked out into the tube. It was four paces across and enclosed with blue Luxin so thin it was almost clear. The bottom of the walkway was thicker blue, reinforced with thin bars of yellow. It looked impossibly thin. As Kip had seen from far, far below, the walkway attached to the prism's tower only at two places, on the east side and here on the west. After going straight out about halfway to the green tower that was directly west of the prism's tower, this walkway met a great, almost clear Luxin circular walkway. From that circle there were spokes out to each of the six towers. Liv led Kip out to one of those intersections between circle and spokes, the point farthest from any support. She jumped up and down.
"See, totally safe," she laughed. "Now you try it."
"I don't know," Kip said. If he could ever overcome his fear, the view from up here was magnificent. Of course, it was hard to look at mere magic towers when he had Liv right here.
"Okay,"
he said weakly. He didn't want to let her down. Of course, if I break this spindly walkway, I'll be letting us both down. The quick way. Trying to be a good sport, Kip hopped, a little landing as lightly as possible on his toes, and absorbing all the shock in his knees.
Oh, seriously, Liv said.
Kip sighed and jumped so high he thought he was going to touch his head on the canopy. As he landed, he heard a loud crack. He threw his hands out, looking for something to grab, his heart seizing up. He was about to throw himself at the handrail when he saw Liv's face. She laughed and covered her mouth.
I am so sorry, she said. I shouldn't have. It's kind of a tradition for new students, and the prison wanted me to give you the whole experience.
Kip looked at her hands. They seemed to be clenched around something invisible. He tightened his eyes, and, sure enough, she had a bar of superviolet Luxin snapped in her hands. Kip chuckled. It only sounded a little forced.
Give me the traditional mop, would you? I think I left a traditional paddle.
She laughed.
Thanks for being a good sport. If it makes you feel better, I almost fainted when my magister did it with our whole class. Come on, it's just a little farther now.
They walked together around the spindly circle, then turned toward the yellow tower. The yellow tower had been at the back right when Kip had entered the great yard, so he hadn't really seen it. Now it loomed both above and below.
I think my eyes are full, Kip said.
What?
I've seen too many amazing things today. Either this is just not as impressive, or I've lost my ability to be amazed, because to me this looks like a plain yellow tower. No flames, no jewels, no twisty movement.
The tower was luminous, but otherwise it looked like cloudy yellow glass, translucent, but not transparent. Maybe it was hard to see because the sun was going down beside the tower. Liv smiled. He didn't know how he'd forgotten her dimples.
The yellow is amazing, because it's made entirely of yellow Luxin.
And the others aren't, Kip said, not understanding. He blinked. I mean, they're not made of their own coloured Luxin?
No, no, no. The others have magical facades built over traditional building materials. The yellow is made entirely of yellow.
From his admittedly brief instruction with the prism, Kip thought that yellow was used like magical lanolin or something. It nourished other Luxin, but otherwise degraded back into light easily.
I thought yellow was kind of a bad choice for a building material, being unstable and all.
Kip was just remembering why he had been keeping his mouth shut. The more he talked with Liv, the more natural it would be for him to talk about home, and the more unnatural for him not to say anything about home. The moment they went there, he was going to have to tell Liv her father was dead, and the pleasant ease of being in her company would be shattered. She would go from this bright, glowing, dimpled young woman to a bereaved orphan.
It is a bad choice, Liv said. That's why this is so amazing.
She pulled him toward the tower's entrance. Suddenly Kip didn't know if he wanted to leave the solidity of the blue-yellow spindles. Sure, a minute ago I was worried to step out on these, and now I don't want to leave.
Yellow is usually the least stable Luxin. It shimmers right back into light at the least movement, like water boiling away in a moment. That's why they call it bright water. But do you remember when that harper played a few years ago back in Recton, and he stopped between every song to retune his harp?
Kip nodded.
It didn't seem to make any difference to me.
Dangerous ground talking about anything back home, but if he could keep her talking until he collapsed from exhaustion, he might avoid telling her the news for one more day. Liv said,
The thing was, he could tell when his harp was even a fraction out of tune. No one else could, though. There are people who can do that with light. To make Luxin of any colour, you have to hit the right note within the colour or the Luxin won't form. If you're only approximately on pitch, the Luxin is much more likely to fail. You can cover some mistakes with more will, but you need someone really special to do work like this.
Does this have something to do with superchromats? Kip asked. It felt like he was finally starting to put together some pieces.
Yes.
She seemed surprised that he'd heard of that.
You're not really going to stand out there all night, are you?
Oh. Kip followed her into the tower.
Superchromats can see finer gradations in colours than most people.
Are you one? Kip asked.
Mm-hmm. About half of all women are.
But not that many men.
There are only 10 male superchromats in the entire Chromaria.
Ah. Thus Mistress Hag calling Kip a freak.
That doesn't seem fair, Kip said.
What does Fair have to do with it? Because you're blue-eyed, you'll be able to draft more than I can. It's not a matter of Fair.
Kip frowned.
So you've got to be a super chromat to make yellow stay? Short answer, yes. In truth, even superchromacy has degrees to it. You took that superchromacy test and there were maybe 100 blocks with fine gradations. Imagine there were 1,000 blocks with the gradations of colour that much finer. To make solid yellow that will stay, you'd have to pass that test and then have the control to draft yellow in that tight, tight spectrum. The result, though, is the strongest of any Luxon.
Can you do it? Kip asked.
No.
Ah, that was probably a rude question, huh? Kip asked, wrinkling his face.
I'm the last person here who's going to hold the minutiae of tower etiquette against you.
Which is a yes.
Yes, she said, smiling. Why were dimples so beautiful anyway? I still can't believe you're the Prism's nephew, Kip.
You're not the only one, Kip said. So Gavin had been right. They all did pause before they said nephew. He guessed it should have felt better than hearing that he was a bastard all the time. It didn't. They got on another lift and went down. Apparently there was some sort of order of precedence for who got what rooms. When they got into Liv's rooms, Kip was surprised. It was not only large, but it was a suite of rooms, and facing the sunset. This had to be the kind of room most drafters would kill for.
I just moved here, Liv said apologetically. I'm a bichrome. Barely. I'm sure you're exhausted. You can sleep in my bed.
Kip looked at her, flabbergasted, sure that she wasn't saying what he thought she was saying, trying not to let his expression say anything at all.
I'll sleep in the next room, silly. These new carpets are so thick I can sleep on them like a Parian.
Kip swallowed.
No, I didn't think you were... I mean, I was just... I was thinking I shouldn't take your bed.
I should sleep in the next room.
You're my guest, and you've got to be exhausted. I insist.
I don't want to get your bed all dirty. I'm sweaty and gross from the testing. Kip was looking at her bed. It was beautiful. Everything here was beautiful. At least they'd been treating her well.
The thresher does that to people. I'll get you a basin and you can sponge off a little before you pass out. But really, I insist.
Liv disappeared into the next room. Kip felt a lump growing in his throat. He hadn't said anything so far about her father, but he could practically feel the subject growing between them. Liv came back in the room with steaming hot water, a sponge, and a thick towel. She set them down and then sat in a chair, facing away from Kip.
You don't mind if I sit here and chat while you wash, do you? She asked. I won't turn around, swear.
Of course he minded. She'd turn around when he was half naked and run screaming from the room for Orholm's sake. It was one thing for someone to know you were rotund, but it was something else entirely for them to see your fat rolls. At the same time, he was her guest and she hadn't asked anything else of him, and he'd been rude.
So, Kip, how's my father? You haven't said anything about home.
For a long moment, Kip couldn't say anything. Just start talking, Kip. Once you start, you'll be able to tell her everything.
You're sighing, Liv said. Is something wrong?
You know how the satrap would send messengers to Recton every year, asking for levies?
Yes,
Liv said, her voice rising more with concern than asking a question.
You can turn around, I'm not naked.
She turned. When Satrap Haradul's son Rask took power, he declared himself king. He sent another messenger. The town sent that one away empty-handed too, so he decided to make an example of us. Kip heaved a deep breath.
They killed everyone, Liv. I'm the only one who got away. My father? What about my father? He was trying to save people. But Liv, they completely surrounded the town. No one got out. You got out?
She didn't believe him. He could see it on her face.
I was lucky. My father is one of the most talented drafters of his generation. Don't tell me that you made it out and he didn't. They had drafters and mirror men, Liv, and I watched the Del Clara family get run down, all of them. The whole town was on fire. I watched Ram and Issa and Sanson die. I watched my mother die. I don't care about your drug-addled mother. I'm talking about my father. Don't you tell me he's dead. He's not, damn you, he's not.
Liv left the room in a whirlwind and slammed the door behind her.
Kip stared at the door, his shoulders slumped, tears that he didn't even understand in his eyes. Well, that went well. Chapter 47 7 years, seven great purposes, Gavin. Gavin held his right hand out and counted up from his thumb, drafting each colour in turn, thumb to pinky, to ring finger, to middle finger, to index finger, back to middle, to ring, to pinky. A seven count, each colour in turn, from sub-red to super-violet, feeling the little thread of emotion from each. For Holland's sake, I'm the prism. I am the whole man, master of all colours. In my prime. Stronger than any prism in living memory, maybe the strongest for hundreds of years. Most prisms only lived 7 years after their ascension. Only four had made it to 21 years, always in multiples of seven. Of course, they could be killed or die of natural causes, too, but none burned out except on the multiple years. Gavin had made it to 16, so he had at least 5 years left. In fact, if any prism could make it past 21 years, he would be the one to do it. He felt strong. He felt stronger and more in control of his colours than he had in his whole life. Of course, it could all be an illusion. He'd been exceptional in other ways. Perhaps he'd pitch over and die tomorrow. He felt that familiar tightness in his chest again at the thought. He wasn't afraid of death, but he was afraid of dying before he accomplished his purposes. He stood outside his father's apartments in the prison's tower. His father's slave, Gavin knew the man's name was Grinwoody, though it was rude to use a slave's name if they didn't reveal it to you themselves, was waiting, holding the door open. It was a door into darkness, of more than one kind. There was sharp pain in Gavin's chest. It was hard to breathe. Andros Guile didn't know Gavin wasn't Gavin. He didn't know his elder son was rotting under the Chromeria. He thought Dazen was dead, and he'd never seemed concerned about it, much less sorry. Traitors were to be dismissed and never spoken of. "Lord Prism?" the slave asked. Gavin shook the last tendrils of Luxin from his fingers, the waft of resinous smells a small comfort. Andros Guile's room was kept completely dark. Thick velvet drapes had been hung over the windows, then the whole wall hung with more of the same in layers. An entry chamber had been erected around the entrance so that light from the hallway wouldn't come in with his few visitors. Gavin drew in superviolet light and then stepped into the entry. Grinwoody pulled the door shut behind them. Gavin drew a little ball of superviolet into his hand, drafted imperfectly so it would be unstable. The instability caused it to slowly disintegrate back into the light of its own spectrum. For a superviolet drafter, it was like carrying a torch whose light was invisible to everyone else. Neither Grinwoody nor Andros was a superviolet, so Gavin could have as much of the eerie violet light as he wanted. As Gavin watched, Grinwoody pushed a heavy pillow in front of a slight crack at the bottom of the door behind them. The man paused, letting his eyes become used to the darkness. He wasn't a drafter, so he couldn't directly control his eyes. In darkness it took a non-drafter, half an hour or more to reach full sensitivity to light. Most drafters naturally could do it in 10 minutes just from spending so much time attuned to light. A few could reach full light sensitivity in seconds. But Grinwoody wasn't trying to see. He had obviously memorized the layout of the room years ago. He was simply making sure he wasn't allowing any light into High Master Guile's chamber. Finally, satisfied, he opened the door. Gavin was glad to be holding superviolet. Like all drafters, he'd been taught not to rely on colours to change his moods. Like most, he failed often. It was a particular temptation for polychromes. There was a colour for every feeling, or to counteract every feeling, like right now. Using the superviolet spectrum was attended by a sense of remove or alienation or otherness. Sometimes it seemed ironic or cynical. Always it was like looking down at himself from above. You're the prism, and you're afraid of an old man. In the superviolet light of his torch, Gavin saw his father sitting in a high-backed, padded chair, turned toward a covered, boarded-up window. Andros Guile had been a tall, powerfully built man. Now his weight had dropped from his broad shoulders to form a little ball in his paunch. He wasn't corpulent, it was just that what weight he had was in his gut. His arms and legs had grown thin from years spent hardly moving from that chair, his skin loose and spotted already at 65.
"Son, so good of you to come visit. An old man grows lonely."
"I'm sorry, Father. The white keeps me very busy."
"You shouldn't be so supine with that weird wench. You should arrange for the hag to join the freeing this year."
Gavin let that pass without comment. It was an old argument. The white said the same things about Andros, minus the derogation. Gavin sat beside his father and studied him in the eerie superviolet light of his torch. Despite the absolute darkness of the room, Andros Guile wore blackened spectacles moulded tight around his eye sockets. Gavin couldn't imagine living in utter darkness. He hadn't even done that to his brother. Andros Guile had been a yellow to sub-red polychrome. Like so many other drafters during the False Prisms War, he'd pushed himself to his absolute limit. And beyond. He'd fought, of course, for his eldest son. Using too much magic, he'd finally destroyed his body's defences against it. But after the war, when so many drafters had taken the freeing, Andros had instead withdrawn to these rooms. When Gavin had first come to visit Andros here, there had been blue filters set on the windows. With his own power at the opposite end of the spectrum, Andros had felt safe with blue light. Since then, the Chirurgeons had told him he needed complete darkness if he was to keep fighting the colours. If he was taking such extreme precautions, he must be very close to the brink indeed.
"I hear you're trying to start a war," Andros said.
"I rarely try without succeeding, I'm afraid," Gavin said. He didn't bother marvelling that his father already knew. Of course Andros Guile knew. The man owned the loyalty or the fear of half of the most powerful women and men in the Tower.
"How?"
"I received a letter that I had a natural son in Tyria. When I arrived, the town was burning. I stumbled across some mirror men about to murder a child, and I stopped them."
"Killed them?"
"Yes. The child turned out to be my natural son, and the men turned out to be Ras Cardools. He was making an example of the town for refusing to send levies. He claimed a special interest in the boy, but I'm not sure if that was just because he thought it would hurt me."
"A special interest? I thought he was there to punish the village."
"He said Kip had stolen something from him."
"And had he?"
"The boy claimed his mother had given him a jewellery case just before dying from injuries she took during the attack. He didn't steal it, though."
"But you have the dagger. Is it the White Luxon?"
A chill shot down Gavin's spine. He thought the worst part of this interview would be his father picking through the details of affairs that Gavin hadn't actually had and thus couldn't remember. A White Luxon dagger? White Luxon wasn't possible. And for Andros Guile to speak about it like this meant he thought that it was. Or knew that it was. That he'd seen such a thing, and that he thought Gavin should know what he was talking about. His brother had mentioned a dagger, too. Gavin's chest tightened. If he wasn't very careful, he was going to ruin his disguise. This was why he avoided his father as much as possible. Andros Guile was one of the few people who would know exactly which memories Gavin would have and which Dazen would have. Others who knew had been alienated or killed during the war. The feeble excuse that the severity of the brothers' fight to the death had made Gavin forget things would only go so far. Andros, in particular, might forgive him for misremembering things that happened in the run-up to the final battle, but surely Gavin would remember things that had happened years earlier, wouldn't he? "I didn't see the dagger," Gavin said. "It was in a box. It didn't even occur to me it might be the White Luxon." White Luxon was impossible. Gavin would know. He'd tried to make the mythic material himself, and as a prism he would be the one who was able to do it if it could be done at all.
"Idiot boy. I don't know why I always favoured you. Dazen was smarter by half. But I always took your side, didn't I?"
Gavin looked at the ground and nodded. The first kind word he'd heard from his father about himself in years, and it was delivered as a rebuke.
Are you nodding your head or shaking it? In case you'd forgotten, I'm blind,
Andros said bitterly.
Never mind. I understand your own secrecy in hunting the dagger. Even my spies haven't heard of you bumbling about, so bravo for that. But when you stumbled across a suspicious dagger that some halfpenny king wanted badly, that didn't send shivers up the back of your neck?
I was surrounded by 30 hostile drafters, mirror men, and an extremely put-out king. I had plenty of shivers. Andros Guile waved his hand, like none of that was worth considering.
With no blackguards guarding you, I suppose? Stubborn fool boy. What was the box made of?
Rosewood, maybe? Gavin said honestly.
Rosewood.
Andros Guile sighed deeply.
Alone it proves nothing, of course, but it tells you what you have to do.
I was planning to rally the 7 satrapies, speak to each directly, see if I could sway them, Gavin said. The spectrum, of course, will do nothing. He knew how this went. His father would announce what Gavin would do and run right over everything Gavin threw in his path. For Hollum's sake, I'm the prism.
And by the time you've done that, King Haradul will have taken Garston. You were right in everything you told the Spectrum, though you drew the wrong lesson and the wrong course of action, which is why you have me. If you had spoken with me as soon as you returned, I'd have told you this. By withdrawing unilaterally and giving a jewel into Tyrian hands—
Hardly a jewel, Father.
You dare interrupt! Come here!
Woodenly, Gavin sat across from his father. Andros Guile extended a hand and found Gavin's face. He traced Gavin's cheek almost gently. Then he drew his open hand back and cracked it across Gavin's cheek.
I am your father, and you will give me the respect you owe me. Understood?
Gavin trembled, swallowed, mastered himself. Understood, father. Andros Guile's chin lifted as if he was sifting Gavin's tone for anything displeasing. Then, as if nothing had happened, he continued.
Haradul covets Garriston. For even if it's a tower of feces built on a plain of ordure, giving it to him is weakness. The right course would be to raise the city and slave the inhabitants and sow the fields with salt, and leave before he arrived. But you've destroyed that option with your incompetence. And once King Haradul holds Garriston with 20,000 men, you'll find it a lot harder to take back than he's going to find it to take when only 1,000 are holding it.
The Hrothgari only have 1,000 men holding Garriston? Gavin asked. It was less than a skeleton crew. If he hadn't been in such a hurry when he sculled through Garriston, he surely would have noticed.
Troubles with the Abornians hiking the tariff to travel through the Narrows again. The Hrothgari are making a statement with a show of force. They pulled the ships and most of the soldiers from Garriston.
That's moronic. They have to know Haradul is massing troops.
I agree. I think the Hrothgari foreign minister has been suborned. She's smart. She must know what she's doing. Regardless, you must go to Garriston. Save the city, kill Rask Haradul. But even if you fail those, get that dagger. Everything rests on that.
What? Everything? Here was the problem with pretending to know secrets you didn't know. Secrets, especially big, dangerous secrets, tended to be referred to obliquely, especially when the conspirators' new spies were frequently eavesdropping on them. Maybe I should have taken my chances with claiming to have forgotten what the dagger was. There had been a time when Daisen had known all of Gavin's secrets, even those that were supposed to be just between Gavin and their father. Daisen and Gavin hadn't just been brothers. They'd been best friends. Though Daisen was 2 years younger, Gavin treated him like an equal. Sebastian was younger. They made him stay home. Gavin and Daisen had the same friends. Together they won and lost fistfights against the White Oak brothers. Gavin missed the simplicity of those fights. Two sides, lots of fists, and once one side started bleeding or crying, the fight was over. But Gavin had changed on the day he turned 13. Daisen was not yet 11 at the time. Andros Guile had come in his dress, robes looming, impressive in red-gold brocade and red-gold chains around his neck. Even then, after having been a member of the Spectrum for a decade, Andros Guile had always been referred to as Andros Guile, never Andros Red.
Everyone had always known which was the more important. Andros had taken Gavin away. When Gavin came back the next morning, his eyes were swollen like he had been crying, though he angrily denied it when Daisen asked. Whatever had happened, Gavin was never the same. He was a man now, he told Daisen, and he refused to play with him. When the White Oak brothers tried to pick a fight, Gavin filled himself with such deep sub-red that the heat emanated from him in waves, and he quietly told the brothers that if they attacked him, the result would be on their own heads. In that moment, Daisen knew Gavin really would have killed them too. From then on, Gavin had spoken to their father as a confidant. Daisen had been left to fall by the wayside. For a time he'd played with Sebastian. Then Sebastian was taken too, and he'd been alone. Daisen had hoped, when he turned 13, he'd be welcomed back into their graces, but his father had barely acknowledged the date. When it came time for it to be divined whom Orholm had chosen to be his next prism, all of Big Jasper and Little Jasper was a whirl of speculation, but Daisen knew his older brother was the one. How it happened didn't matter. Andros had been grooming Gavin to be prism for his whole life. And I was groomed to be nothing. A cast-off to marry Caris Whiteoak or some other girl to deflect some other father's ambitions, until Gavin tried to take even that from me. The hardest part of maintaining his disguise was here, not in pretending to be Gavin, but in being reminded of all Gavin had had and that Daisen never would. So, go to Garriston, save it or burn it, kill Caradhul and get the dagger. Sounds simple enough. If Gavin did things right, that would fulfill one of his purposes, and set the stage for another. Andros said,
I'll give you letters to the Hrothgari to make sure they'll obey you.
You're going to make me the governor of Garriston? Every time Gavin forgot how powerful his father was, even from this little room, Andros did something to remind him.
Not officially. If you fail, it would besmirch our name. But I'm making sure that the governor does whatever you tell him.
But the spectrum
can, on occasion, be ignored. It's so not easy to depose a prism, you know. When you return, we'll talk about getting you married. It's time you start making heirs. You showing up with a bastard presses the issue.
Father, I'm not—
If you crush one of the satraps, even a rebel one, you're going to need to buy off one of the others. It's time. You will obey me in this. We'll talk about the bastard problem later.
Chapter 48 Liv had gone to the light garden high in the yellow tower to think, but it seemed she couldn't walk 10 paces without stumbling over some young couple kissing. As the sun went down, the light garden became spectacular, and a favourite of couples. Liv should have remembered. But there was something particularly jarring in the sight of young lovers when she was feeling so isolated. She left, her emotions tumbling over each other, sorry she'd been so rude to Kip, certain she was right that her father was still alive, and scared to death she was wrong. Lonely, scared of her future, and now, hit in the face with how easy everyone else seemed to find it to find someone who liked her. Lonely for a boy. Any boy. Well, practically. Liv had been at the Chromaria for 3 years, and the best she'd done was have a few near misses at relationships. Being Tyrian, being the daughter of a general on the losing side, and being poor had ended most interest before it began. The one boy she thought really cared for her had invited her to the Lux Lord's ball, and then had stood her up and gone with another girl. Apparently it had been a prank. The next year she'd briefly become the object of a competition between some of the most popular boys. For 2 weeks, it was glorious to be the center of attention. She'd felt like she'd finally broken through, that people were finally accepting her. One of them invited her to the Lux Lord's ball. Then she overheard one of the others talking about a wager they had to see who could swive her first. Her revenge had been swift and terrible. She'd promised the boy escorting her to the ball. The leader of the group, a young noble named Parshan Payam, her maidenhead, if he helped her fulfill a naughty dream of hers. He'd practically drooled. At the Lux Lord's ball, they'd met in a darkened nook just off the main hall. She'd convinced Parshan to remove all of his clothes first, despite the proximity of practically the entire Chromaria dancing
talking and drinking mere paces away. Then, pausing from kissing him while his loathsome hands wandered over her body, she asked how much he was going to win for winning the contest.
"You know? You're not mad?"
he asked.
"Why would I be mad?" she asked. "Close your eyes. I've got a surprise for you." "A good surprise?"
he asked. She trailed her fingernails down his belly, looked down, licked her lips.
"It'll take your breath away. Promise."
He closed his eyes. She grabbed all of his clothes and stormed out into the party. He came after her with a yelp, rushing naked into the party.
"This is what you get for your contest, Parshampayam,"
Liv shouted, just so that anyone who hadn't immediately seen the naked young man would notice and know who it was. The dancers stopped. The musicians quit playing. 100 conversations ceased.
"Wagering with your friends on who can take my virginity? You're despicable. A cad and a liar. You disgust me. You're not smart enough to fool me, you're not clever enough to deceive me, and you're not man enough to take me."
She plunged his priceless clothes into the punch bowl. Nervous titters broke out everywhere. Parshan froze. With his clothes soaking in punch, it was pointless to retrieve them to cover himself. He did his best to cover himself with his hands. Amid silence punctuated with scattered applause, Liv stormed out of the hall and straight into Chromeria Legend. Unfortunately, passing into Tower Law for wreaking vengeance on a boy who'd taken a romantic interest in you, regardless of how ignoble that interest was not a good way to encourage interest from others. All the other boys were terrified of her.
"Why am I thinking about boys? My father's dead."
"No, he's not. Father's gotten out of worse things. He wouldn't allow himself to be trapped. He's smarter than that." Still, it would be nice to have someone to talk to. Honestly, a good cry would make her feel a lot better. Liv trudged down to Vina's room, but when she got there, Vina was crying. It broke Liv out of her own self-pity instantly. Vina wasn't just crying, she was bawling. Vina's usually artfully disheveled, boyishly short hair was smashed down on her head as if she'd been holding her head in her hands. Her eyes were swollen.
"I can't believe it, Liv. I've been looking for you everywhere, Liv," Vina said. "It's a disaster. Oh, Hollum, Liv, I'm being sent home."
Looking around the room, Liv saw that all of Vina's stuff was already packed up and in large trunks. With how much stuff Vina owned and all the decorations she'd strewn over every open space in her little room, Liv knew she couldn't have packed it all herself.
"What's going on?"
It took a few minutes to get it all out in some sort of sensible order, even though the story was simple. Vina had lost her sponsorship. The Abornian lord who held her contract had lost a fortune in some business venture and needed to cut his expenses. Apparently he'd shopped Vina's contract around and found no buyers. Some other younger drafter's lord had bought Vina's room from him, though she was to vacate it immediately. Vina had been purchased passage home, tonight. She would have to meet with her sponsor to determine how he could best make back his investment from her. Vina could end up as a serving girl, but she feared her lord might sell her to slavers. It was illegal. A drafter's indenture was a far cry from slavery, but there were always stories of such things.
"Liv, could you loan me some money? I could run away." "I can't. Please, Liv, I'm begging you. I know it's not a loan. I'll never be able to pay you back, but I can't face going back. Please."
Liv's heart dropped. If she'd waited just 1 week to meet the moneylenders, she'd have drawn one more installment of her allowance, and she'd have ample money to help out her friend.
"I just paid off a debt, Vina. I've got nothing left. It cost me everything."
Vina wilted.
"Wait, we could sell some of my dresses. If you can wait until morning—" "No, forget it. They'll be looking for me by then. And they know you're my only friend. They'll be watching you. It was a stupid idea. I need to go face this."
A knock on the door. "Miss?" a man's voice called out. Vina opened the door and 4 men in slaves' clothes came in and picked up the trunks. Vina picked up her own bag.
"Walk me to the docks?" she asked Liv, putting on a brave face.
Still horrified, disbelieving, Liv nodded. They walked slowly as if they could postpone the inevitable forever.
"This really is a great place," Vina said.
as they crossed the bridge for the last time together.
"It's a marvel. And I was here. For a while. My father was a servant. My mother was a servant. There's nothing wrong with going home and serving. I'm not better than they are. And you know what? I met the Prism."
Her eyes were gleaming.
"He called me marvellous. He complimented my dress. Me. He noticed me, Liv, with all those beautiful girls there. No one can take that away from me. How many people, how many drafters never get that much in their whole lives? The Prism himself."
Her bravery made Liv tear up. She studiously avoided looking at Vina, sure she'd lose control if she did. But all too soon they were at the docks. They said their goodbyes, tearfully, promising to write, Liv promising that she would use any connections she could make to get Vina reinstated. Vina smiled sadly, resigned.
"Come on, ladies," the captain said. "Time and the tide wait for no man, nor for blubbering girls neither."
Liv hugged Vina one more time and left. She'd barely stepped off the wood of the dock when she saw a familiar figure lurking in the shadows like a spider. Aglaia Crassos.
"You," Liv said. "This is your work."
Aglaia smiled.
"I wonder, Liv, do you think we owe a debt to our friends? A debt of love? Or duty? Of course we do. But apparently your duty to your friend isn't as important as your need to defy me." "You bitch," Liv said, quivering. "I'm not the one who's letting her friend pay for my pride. It can stop, Liv. Or it can get worse. You still want me to spy on the Prism? Vina's not going home, just so you know. I own her contract already. And I've got a deal with a rather dubious Elition. He's willing to give me a good price for Vina. Most people have scruples about selling drafters. Of course, she's not a full drafter, so she won't be entitled to any of a drafter's normal privileges. But hey, Vina loves sailing, right? Not many women on the galleys. They don't usually last very long, nor do the other slaves treat them well, so owners usually put women to other work. But I can arrange it."
Not just a slave. A galley slave. The worst of the worst. Liv wanted to vomit. She wanted to murder Aglaia. Or Hollum save her.
"Or,"
Aglaia said, "you give me the word." She nodded toward a messenger standing across the street.
"And he runs to the captain with a message, saying it's all a mistake. Vina's been reinstated, and so forth. Wonder of wonders. You are my own special project, Liv. You have my full attention."
Liv looked at the boat, despairing. It was true. She had no friends, no options, no choices. How could she fight Aglaia Crassos with all her wealth and power? If she asked the Prism for help, he'd ask questions. He'd think she'd been spying all along. Every part of the Chromeria and the Satrapies was corrupt. They were all turned against her.
"Hurry, Liv!
The tide's turning," Aglaia said.
There was no way out. No time to try to come up with a third way. Maybe her father would have said no and spat in Aglaia's ugly face and held on to his honour. Liv wasn't that strong. The sharks and sea demons had her.
"Fine,"
she said, her heart failing within her.
"You win. What do I have to do?"
Chapter 49 Gavin hadn't even gotten fully out of his father's apartments when he saw trouble coming. His mother's apartments were right beside his father's, and there was no way he could leave without passing in front of her doors. And her doors were open. Every time. Every burning time. If his father's windows hadn't all been bolted shut and covered with layers of fabric, Gavin would have jumped out of a window. In fact, it was just during one of these sorts of situations that he'd first drafted a bonnet. Every time he came back from even the shortest trip, it seemed he spent all day meeting with one important person after another. All he did was meet with people, and every one of them had demands of him. Nonetheless, Gavin turned in as he went past his mother's open doors. The room slave was a young Tyrian girl, judging from her dark eyes and hair and copy-coloured skin. Gavin motioned to her as he passed that she could close the doors behind him. His mother had a talent for training slaves. Even a girl barely in her teens like this one would wait attentively and respond to the smallest signal. Of course, Gavin wasn't so much different, was he? Mother, Gavin said. She stood as he came close. He kissed her many ringed fingers, and she laughed and embraced him as she always did.
My son, she said.
Felia Gyle was a handsome woman in her early 50s. She had been a cousin of the Atashian royal family, and in her youth, the Atashian noble families rarely married foreigners. Andros Gyle, of course, had been a special case. He always was. She had the classic, striking Atashian pairing of olive skin and cornflower blue eyes, though her blue eyes bore a wide halo of dull orange around the iris. She had been an orange drafter, though she wasn't greatly talented. Andros would never have married a woman who couldn't draft. Slim, despite her age, Felia was regal, fashionable, comfortable in herself, commanding without being domineering, beautiful and warm. He had no idea how she could stand being married to his father. She flicked two fingers of her left hand, dismissing the room slave without taking her eyes off Gavin.
So I hear a rumour that you have a nephew.
Gavin cleared his throat. How fast did word travel in this place anyway? He looked around the room. The slave was gone. That's correct.
A natural son, Felia Gyle said, her lips pulling taut momentarily.
She would never say bastard. With her huge palette of facial expressions, she didn't have to. Over the years, Orange had made her both more empathetic and more suspicious. With her natural intuition and intelligence, it made her quite formidable. That's right. He's a good young man. His name's Kip.
15 years old?
She didn't say, so you cheated on your fiancé, whom I've been urging you to marry for the last 16 years. Felia loved Caris. Andros Gyle had been dead set against Gavin marrying a woman whose family had nothing like Caris's after the war. It was one of the few areas where Gavin's mother had continued to defy his father. Usually when they disagreed, she would let her objections be known with force and eloquence, and then concede to whatever Andros decided. Not a few times Gavin had seen Andros change his mind after his mother so artfully surrendered. The disagreement over Caris Whiteoak, however, had involved screaming, shattered porcelain, and tears. Gavin thought sometimes that if he hadn't been present during that fight, Andros would have given in. But the man couldn't lose face in front of anyone, much less his boundary-pushing son. He is, Gavin said. Felia folded her hands and studied his face.
So, is his existence as much of a surprise to you as it is to everyone else, or more?
A shiver shot down Gavin's spine. His mother was no fool. She was as careful to guard against eavesdroppers as anyone, but she had ways of getting to exactly what she meant. After Sundered Rock, when Gavin had staggered alone out of the magical conflagration, wearing his brother's clothing and his brother's crown and his brother's scars under layers of soot and blood, everyone else had taken him to be Gavin unquestioningly. Despite the age difference, the brothers had been mistaken for twins dozens of times, and their mannerisms were uncannily similar. And Gavin had been careful to emulate his brother's idiosyncrasies of vocabulary and expression. Any differences that had emerged after the war ended had been written off as Gavin having been changed by having to kill his own brother. But Gavin woke the morning of his first night back at the Chromeria to find his mother sitting on the foot of his bed. Her eyes were red and puffy from weeping, though her cheeks were dry. She'd been careful to do her weeping before he woke.
"Did you think I wouldn't know my own boy?" she had asked. "You're the blood of my blood. Did you think you could deceive even me?" "I didn't think it would work this long, Mother. I expected any of 100 people to see through this farce, but what else can I do?" "I understand why you've done what you've done," she said. "I just had braced myself against your death, not your brother's, and now to see you. It's like having to choose which of my remaining sons I prefer to die. No one's asking that of you." "Just tell me this," she said. "Is Gavin dead?"
"Yes," he'd said.
"I didn't want... He gave me no... I'm sorry."
Her eyes had streamed tears, but she ignored them.
"What do you need, Dazen? I've lost both of your brothers. I swear to Orholm I won't lose you. Tell them I'm convalescing. Tell them the battle nearly killed me. When the time is right, tell them it changed me. but don't make me look weak.
And so she'd become his only true ally in the Chromaria. And after she left, he'd barred the door and opened the chest where his drugged brother lay, not a foot from where their mother had stood. He studied the unconscious figure minutely, and then himself in a mirror, taking note of every difference, he set to work. His brother's hair had a cowlick that stuck out whenever he cut it short. The new Gavin would have to wear his hair long, so no one noticed this disparity. Gavin was a little shorter than Dazen, and had liked to wear boots with more heel. The new Gavin would wear flatter shoes. He began writing lists of his brother's mannerisms, the way Gavin liked to pop his neck to the left and right. Or was it right and left? Damn it! Dazen didn't even know how to pop his neck. Gavin liked to shave every day, even twice a day, to keep his face smooth. Dazen had shaved a few times a week, finding it too much bother. Gavin always wore a particular scent. Dazen had never bothered. He'd have to send a servant to fetch it. Gavin cared about his clothing and made sure he was at the forefront of every trend. Dazen didn't even know how he did that. He'd need to look into it. Had Gavin plucked his eyebrows? Dear old Hollum. Other changes were harder to make. Dazen had a mole on the inside of one elbow. Grimacing, he sliced it off. It would become a little scar. No one would notice.